Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Stargirl Squadcast. I'm Cameron.
I'm Adiba.
I'm Tam.
And you might be wondering what on earth we're doing here today, since the show has kind of been over for a hot minute. Well, we are very excited and honored to have Steve Harper, who was a writer on the show, as well as one of the co-executive producers, with us today.
Yeah, super happy to be here and happy, as always, to discuss Stargirl.
Yeah, awesome. So we have a couple questions just about like your background, getting into like work in the industry and that sort of stuff with your career before we get into the bulk of the Stargirl specific questions, of which we have many. But I guess one of the first questions that we have to address is, I know that you've been writing for a few decades at this point.
Yes.
But how exactly did you get your foot in the door in the industry?
In the TV writing industry.
Yes. Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah. I was going to make a joke about having superpowers, but I sort of lost the thread. I entered the industry as an actor years ago, and I still do some acting, although it's not in the driver's seat of my life. And I got really tired of, this is sort of going way back, I was doing a lot of regional theater and sort of living out of a box. So I would take my box to Cincinnati and then take my box to, you know, St. Louis or whatever. And I was like, I can't keep roaming around the country doing this. I'd like to be home, you know? So I started writing plays and then eventually went to playwriting school, was lucky enough to get into the Juilliard playwriting program, which was amazing. And out of there, I got an agent, which didn't happen right away, but it eventually happened. And the agent said, are you interested in television? Now, one of the interesting things too about this particular, you know, to sort of, again, jump back in time, is that years before, I was living in Baltimore and the Warner Brothers people created this curriculum about how to write television. And they were looking for, as people, we're always, I think, on some level, trying to both populate writers' rooms in Hollywood with more people of color and train people how to, you know, create good scripts. So they thought, we have this methodology to teach people to write. Let's send this curriculum to some historically Black colleges and universities to try to get people to, you know, learn how to do this. And so years before any of this happened, one of those modules came to Baltimore, where I was living at the time. And I actually took a writing for television course sponsored by Warner Brothers at Morgan State University. This was like years and years.
Yeah. Oh, I think my uncle went there. Yeah.
Oh, cool. Yeah. So then when this agent is like, are you interested in TV? I was like, yeah. I was kind of obsessed with TV. And I already had the basic skills to write TV scripts. And I thought, absolutely. Very interestingly, I spent about 5 years coming back and forth from, I was living in New York. I would come out to LA on my own dime, put myself up in a hotel, and my agents would set up basically what was 15 meetings in a week, like five meetings a day for, you know, or three meetings a day for 5 days. And every third person was like, you know, you really need to live out in LA to do that. You really need to be here. And I wasn't ready to do that. But years later, I was. So I moved out to LA in 2010 and had a very challenging year that year, even though, you know, I'd met a bunch of people and my agents at the time were like, you've met everybody, which of course can't possibly be true. But eventually they suggested that I apply to some of these diversity programs that lots of networks and studios have to teach, you know, to not only to teach people more about the TV writing stuff, but really about the TV writing life. So I learned more about how the industry works, how to network, how to take meetings, what showrunners are looking for, you know, how to introduce myself, all these nitty gritty things. And then within several months of me graduating from that program, I got my first TV writing job on Covert Affairs on the USA Network. And that was in 2012. And that's how it all started.
Yeah, that's actually really cool. Like, I don't know if you've heard of the DC Milestone Project, but it was...
No.
Launched last year by DC Comics. It was something that I actually applied to, which was trying to recruit people of color, specifically like Black comic book writers who were like not very experienced, but were motivated to go, send them to Warner Brothers and try to start a like special, I think it was a special issue that they wanted to do for I think it was like their 2021 like Black superhero special issue.
Yes,
I think there's Rocket and Icon and probably like,
I think Static also Shock, currently on Blood Syndicate, I think is also being written by them. They've kept the team.
That's great. I know that they tried it. I know that right now, I think they said that they wanted to do it again, but then COVID happened and didn't work out. Like they said that they had wanted to, you know, like cast a wide application pool. So like I'm in Canada and they said like open to Canada. And I was like, oh, that's great. And they didn't end up picking anyone in Canada, I think because of the travel restrictions and everything. So very hopeful that they do that again, because opportunities like that are so cool. Like you never even think that you could be given the chance to do something like that. So.
No, I think that's really great. I also think too, and you know, we may get into this a little bit later, but I'm a big fan of, you know, I coach writers as well as write myself, and I'm a big fan of people creating their own stuff. So I feel like it's great to get into these programs. That's all fantastic. And, you know, if you're not able to do that, like, you know, put some, you know, raise some money, crowdfund, like make your own comic books, like, you know, do a thing that sort of can potentially get you noticed. That's another great way. The industry is always looking for people who already know how to do the kinds of things they want to do. So that's a great way to put yourself on the map, I think. We can all try to do that more, I think.
That's very cool. So we saw that you've written a lot of short plays and films that premiered during lockdown. What does that writing, directing, acting process look like? And have there been any lessons you've learned that can help when you're staging more real life performances?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think, you know, to me, the core of what I've learned both during the pandemic by doing, you know, the heart of the pandemic, I should say, because it's still with us. But, you know, during that period of time with short pieces and with playwriting in general, like what I really feel like I learn over and over again is how simple drama can be, you know, and I feel fortunate to be a playwright and to have come into the industry through playwriting, because I think lots of people who, this is my generalization, lots of people who come into the industry specifically interested in television or film are really sometimes enticed by the grandeur of it all. They're like, okay, I can create a story if I can have a car crash and an explosion and a tornado and a couple of monsters and some special effects, you know. And we playwrights are like, I need two people and a table. and we know how to sort of take the human sort of element, the human emotions, and have two people kind of like, you know, bump up against each other without necessarily the need for, you know, pyrotechnics or all that stuff. And I think it's really the same thing is true of the purity of short plays. I've written a lot of short plays. Actually, just last year came out with a collection of short works that you can buy called A Few Short Plays to Save the World that you can find on Amazon and BarnesandNoble.com and other outlets. And it's some of my favorite short plays that I've written over the decades. And, you know, it's full of like wacky, diverse characters and magical realism and, you know, all sorts of stuff like that. But what I really love about the 10-minute play form is that it's super simple. The characters have to come in, do something, and get out. Like you can't waste a lot of time with exposition or, again, with special effects. There's something about the purity of relationships. And I think that always helps with writing.
Okay, so we're going to pivot now into Stargirl-specific questions. So I guess the big starting question is, how did you get involved on Stargirl? And we know that you served as a supervising producer and a co-executive producer on the show in addition to your writing credits. So what exactly does that entail? Like, it sounds like a large plate, but very exciting one.
Yes, it is a very exciting one. Well, I'll tell you how I got the job, and then we could talk about like what the job looked like from the inside. So I had come off of Godfriended Me, which I was on the final season of, which was a super fun show, also a Warner Brothers show. And it was my first entry into the Warner Brothers, I guess I'll say, family. And, you know, and sort of what that means, you know, just for anybody who doesn't know, is that in the television world, you know, there's obviously the network where it airs, and then there's the studio, you know, which is another entity that sort of, you know, pays the bills and sort of funnels the right. So you have a Warner Brothers show on CBS, or you have a Warner Brothers show on the CW, or you have a Warner Brothers produced show that's on Netflix, you know. So you've got these two entities. And what that means day to day for a writer like me is that we are both working with our showrunner to create, you know, the show, the episodes. And then we get notes you know, we get comments and feedback from people from the studio who are paying the bill. So they have the right to sort of say, well, we don't quite understand or blah, blah, blah. And then people from the network, because the network's going to air it and they have the right to say, well, wait a minute, we don't understand. Right. So you are literally building relationships with these people, because every time you write an episode, you got to talk to somebody from the studio and the network in order to sort of make it to the final draft of the script. So being in the Warner Brothers family actually made my transition to Stargirl a little bit easier. You know, Geoff Johns, the showrunner of Stargirl, was looking for a writer for his second season, which is when I joined the show. And there were actually a couple of other Warner Brothers shows that I actually won't name that I was almost on, like a couple of other places where like I was getting offers from other showrunners. And it was very interesting because in the Warner Brothers family, the showrunners are always turning to the studio people and the network people. And those, you know, every writer has to be vetted by those people because, you know, the Warner Brothers, CBS, CW, you know, those executives know writers too. And so they might be like, well, why don't you hire so-and-so, or why don't you, you know? And I was very fortunate that the Warner Brothers people knew me and liked me. So Warner Brothers was like, yeah, thumbs up on Steve Harper, you know, sure. So that was really nice. And Geoff was amazing. Like I work with an agent and a manager, and I had heard through the manager that, that Geoff was looking, and they set up a meeting and we had a meeting and we just really hit it off. It was like a terrifically fun, bouncy conversation as Geoff sort of does. And then he said, come on, let's do this thing. So that was cool. The other thing that was super cool for me is that I've been a huge comic book geek my whole life. I have to say that I'm not currently collecting, so I'm not all up to date. But I have from childhood, actually in this house on the first floor, I've got 1,200 comic books, you know.
Oh, wow.
Bagged and boarded.
Oh,
and,
my gosh.
You know, and largely from, you know, 70s, 80s. I've been planning to sell them. I haven't done it yet. So I've always wanted to be, you know, ever since I was a kid, I was like, oh, we need more superheroes on TV and in movies. And we're finally doing it. Mm-hmm. And I was just over the moon to have the opportunity to be on a superhero show because I'd never gotten to do it. And it's part of my DNA. So what's interesting, the main thing that's interesting about the writing, or one of the interesting things about the writing industry, TV writing industry, particularly for people who are, you know, who are new to it or don't know sort of the inner workings, is that there are a bunch of hierarchies. One of the things I really dig, you know, having spent several decades with acting in the driver's seat, is that in acting, there's no hierarchy. Like you could be in one play or one show and you're the lead. And then the next thing you're like, you know, guy from the left carrying a spear. And then the next thing you're the lead again. And then the next thing you're like, it's not like once you've gone up to a certain level, you can't go down. So actors are always big part, little part, small part, you know, cameo, blah, blah, blah. But in the television writing industry, there's a ladder of hierarchy. And interestingly enough, all of those levels have names. And I'll tell you what the names are in a moment, but only one of those levels has the word writer in the title, oddly enough. And that's the very low, that's the entry level, which is very strange. So staff writer is the lowest level, the entry level in the writer's room space. So it goes staff writer, story editor, executive story editor, co-producer, producer, supervising producer, co-executive producer, executive producer. Okay. So hopefully if you stick around and don't get fired and advance and people like you, you get bumped up a different level, either every season of TV or maybe every two seasons of TV, depending. And so I say all that to say that my life as a supervising producer and a co-executive producer on Stargirl was no different. It was different because I had a different title and a little more money to do the job, but essentially it was the same job that every writer does, especially on Stargirl, where, you know, Geoff was always the one, partly because of COVID, Geoff was always the one who went to set, who talked to the actors, who talked to the directors, who was in post, who did editing. On several other shows, you know, again, depending on who runs it, because every show is run differently, you as a writer might be the one to go to set, might be the one to talk to the director, might be the one to sit in editing, as I did on God Friended Me. We did a lot of that kind of stuff. But on Stargirl, basically I, you know, helped break stories in the room and helped write scripts, you know, which is sort of a whole process. And you got to do an outline, you know, story area slash outline is sort of the first level after we know what it's generally going to be. And we've put up the beats on the board. We send that into the studio, get notes from the studio, change things, then send it to the network, get notes from the network, change things, then go to script and take that outline story area and turn it into a, whatever it is, 42, 40, you know, three, whatever it is, however long our scripts ought to be, depends on the show and stuff. And then we send that script into the studio and the network and get notes from them. And then eventually we have a production draft and that goes to the director and the actors and, you know, that's the process. And then maybe there are notes then changes after, you know, after production starts. And sometimes you make those, sometimes somebody else makes those, maybe Jeff would make those. And it just goes on and on like that. And you move on to the next episode and plan it the same way. And there's another writer who's planning to, you know, who's at the forefront of that episode and will do those steps. And that's essentially the way it works.
Okay. Interesting. Really cool. So then from my understanding of that, so how does it work when you're specifically credited as the writer for certain episodes? Because am I correct in like you were in the writing room for like each of the episodes that were being written? Yes. So what exactly is the difference between how much are you given more creative control over those specific episodes? Like what, how does that work exactly?
Yeah. Well, essentially not really. So okay. what happens is you become the, and again, all of this depends on the show. Cause if you think about television as, if you think about it from sort of like a corporate or even like a, you know, camp counselor point of view, the showrunner is the head, like camp counselor person, or the showrunner is the CEO. So every showrunner, you know, runs their company, their business in a different way. So on some shows, and the shows that I've been on, and I'll talk specifically about Stargirl, like when it's your episode on some shows, you'll basically run the writer's room. So you'll be the one who's up there at the board, writing on the board, asking questions, soliciting responses, sort of leading the discussion, but everybody's chiming in. Right. And then when you get to the reason I say you don't completely lead it yourself is when you get to some, you know, a choice point, a fork in the road, you basically turn to the showrunner and be like, which of these forks do you like? You know, and the showrunner who's, you know, head camp counselor, CEO, you know, king of the hill gets to say, he or she gets to say, we're going this way. And then we follow the story that way. So ultimately the showrunner says what goes, but you may, as the writer of the episode, lead the actual process in the room. And you'll definitely, at least on Stargirl, you will write that outline. You will write that first draft of the script. And you're the, you know, you're the person who's basically sort of, you know, giving birth on the page to everything that was signed off to by the showrunner.
Oh, that's very insightful. Of all the episodes that you had the opportunity to lead, as you said, which ones were your favorite to write for?
Yeah.
If that's fair to even say.
Good question. In season two, they didn't all have names. So, but yeah. There was the episode where Dr. Midnight, I mean, they all sort of faced off against Eclipso and, you know, and Dr. Midnight and Eclipso faced off in Courtney's house and Eclipso, you know, started spewing racist comments toward Dr. Midnight. That was actually, I think, my most the most interesting episode to work on. So what happened is the story behind that episode is this. We were, you know, we obviously had Jeff came in. One of the great things about Jeff as a showrunner is he always came in. He always comes in with this complete vision of a season. So he came in the very first day of that season and he was like, here's what we're doing. You know, and he told us the story of Eclipso and how it was going to fold out. And he had tent poles for each episode. And he was like, this, blah, 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 right? And so gave us the outline. Same thing for season three. He came in and he sort of knew this vast outline. And then he called on us to fill in the gaps. So you sort of color in here and there. And he's like, what I don't know is this. And I know there's something that happens, blah, blah, blah. And we'll figure that out here in the room. You know, so we had that storyline, which essentially is, that Eclipso finally gets to our characters, finally gets to the Justice Society. And I can't remember what all the details of that were, but Warner Brothers came to Jeff, and Jeff like calls me up, which is a rare event. I mean, you know, he would sometimes call me up, but you know, he calls me up and he's like, Warner Brothers and the CW. And this was sort of, you know, around slash right after the George Floyd murder, and there's a lot of conversation.
For a racism episode.
They said, we want your show. We're asking all our shows to deal in some ways with racism, with you know, with social injustice. And but you know, but we want you to do it in a way that feels very true to your show, and you know. And so we started.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Going back.
Right. So we started having these really intense discussions, like first me and Jeff on the phone and then in the writer's room, about how can we do this and make it seem sort of organic to the show. And it was a thing that came up, you know, that was sparked by me and our consulting producer, who is Asian. And, you know, we started talking about, I started talking about how, you know, as how, you know, there's something in the character of Beth Chappell, you know, be her being so polite and so sunny and so friendly. And I really relate to that as a Black man in the world, because I feel like there is part of me that sort of puts on sunny and shiny as a defense against, you know, police brutality or people
like a people pleaser kind of.
Yes. Yeah, right. And yeah, so, yeah. And so to me, that was such, you know, even without knowing it, you know, as they invented the character and sort of, you know, created her in season one, that was a real, it was a real sort of brilliant stroke of character stuff. So that to me, it seemed like the perfect opportunity to have this woman, you know, be assaulted by Eclipso in a way that jabbed at her sort of trying to be so nice, you know, because it really sort of went to the core of her, you know, her own racial identity. And so we started to play with that. And the funny thing, the wonderful thing was, you know, even through, we were at the first draft and Warner Brothers came back and they were like, can he be meaner? Can he be really more nasty to her? Yes. We were just like, yes, do it. So that was a super fun experience. That's probably my favorite episode to write.
Wow. Well, okay. I'm still processing that because we just had so many questions for season two of like how, it's just funny, like Eclipso's evil, we know that, but he's evil and racist on top of
yes. which was so interesting because I don't believe necessarily that Eclipso has always been racist. To me, it was Eclipso knows what will jab her.
Yeah.
You know, he knows how, you know, he knows how to reach her, how to push her buttons. And those are her buttons, even though we haven't, as an audience, haven't seen those buttons before.
For sure. Yeah, that totally makes sense. Okay, so without getting into anything that, you know, may get you in trouble with, I don't know, the network or Jeff or anything like that, since the show's over, are there any character storylines that you wish could have made into the show that you could tell us, or I guess storylines in general that maybe almost happened but didn't happen, or that you wrestled with in the like the writer's room that was cool?
That the CW shot down. We're like, you cannot put that on the air.
Well, I mean, you know, I think the interesting thing about working for Jeff, because Jeff, you know, as you know, as you ladies know, like Jeff is, you know, Jeff is like king of the mountain. Like he knows a million, like he's been in comic books forever. You know, he's written for everybody. Like he just, his knowledge is, and leadership in that way is unimpeachable. Like he just, you can't, there was nothing that he would, you know, there was never a scenario where he would suggest something to the CW or to, you know, or to Warner Brothers that they would not want to do, because he's more of an expert on those characters and the universe and how the audience wants to see them and how he wants to see them than anybody. So, you know, we never had that kind of thing where we would float something. And also we had, you know, folks from DC too were on our notes calls. So we had a DC representative on every one of the notes calls. But of course, you know, they were super tight with Jeff, and Jeff knew what they, I mean, there was never that kind of pushback. So I wish I could give you some dirt. I don't really have any. I mean, I can tell you this. And this was sort of interesting because I was watching this a lot on Twitter. As you know, I tweet a lot, you know, did a lot of live tweeting during the show.
So did Diva.
Yeah, no, so did I.
It's so fun, right? People were really obsessed with whether or not Dr. Midnight would get a new costume, right?
And
what's really interesting about that is we talked about that in the writer's room. And the bottom line is, and this sounds really pedestrian, and I'm sorry, but it's the fact costumes are really expensive.
I'm sure. Yeah.
And we just couldn't, you know, in terms of trying to figure out how to make the best show possible that looks really great with the special effects we have and the, you know, all of it and the fight choreography and all of that. There was no way, you know, every time I saw that, people were like, oh, where's the new costume? Like, there was no way that was going to be added to our budget.
I had said that, like, okay, so we have, like, you know, our own blogs and like, I was like having this debate for so long saying, guys, I'm sure that was just a throwaway line as like for fun. And the real frenemies dynamic for Beth was going to be the relationship with her parents and how to navigate that, not the costume. Like, it's not about the costume, but everyone was like, it's about the costume. So it's very funny. Yeah.
Yeah. It just costs a lot of money. That's the bottom line.
So obviously different characters in the show have very distinct voices from one another. And it's your job as a writer to convey facets of their personalities through their dialogue. So were there any characters in particular that you found like super easy to write for? And on the other side of the coin, were there any that you were like, I have so much difficulty getting into this headspace?
Well, you know, that's a really excellent question. I mean, I think that, there are a couple of levels to that. Number one, the main level for any TV writer is that it's a job about imitation, right? So what happens is your showrunner, whoever he or she is, creates a blueprint for the show and writes the characters before anybody else. And then when you get hired to support creating the show week after week, you're basically being hired to imitate what your boss did on the first time out, right? So I'm trying to imitate Jeff's version of Courtney, Jeff's version of, you know, anybody else. And so it's really about like, how does he say they sound? And, you know, I literally like go back to previous scripts and like, let me read some of their dialogue again or watch previous episodes and go, oh yeah, they have this turn of phrase or they have, you know, so it's really this imitative space. I have to say though, having said that, I loved writing, for Courtney and Cameron. Like, I just thought that was super fun. And in fact, you know, one of the episodes I wrote in season three that I co-wrote with Maytal Jutt, who was working as our script coordinator and got to work on that script with me, you know, we divided up the scenes and I really wanted those Courtney and Cameron scenes because I was really excited to like do that. You know, the other thing too that's very interesting that you may find interesting is that Jeff has a philosophy about characters in relationships. So you'll notice that in Stargirl, there weren't a lot of relationships, right? And that's because Jeff believes, and I've heard other showrunners believe this too, that basically if you get two characters together, you're gonna have to break them apart. So like, what's the point of that? You know, it's only gonna lead to bad things if you get people together. Now, for some reason, I'd love to be able to say that I was, you know, responsible, but I wasn't. For some reason, he got convinced in season three that Courtney and Cameron should get together. And then, you know, and then I got to write some of those scenes. So in the episode that I'm talking about, which was the one where, you know, Icicle is back and he goes to his family.
We have a question about that. We were like, we wanted to know all the details.
but you know, Maytal and I divided up those scenes and I really made sure that I got the Courtney and Cameron stuff that sort of went in there. And I had written the earlier episode where they first got together and kissed, you know, so I was sort of really excited about just being able to do that kind of human stuff. Cause for me, that's what I love most in the superhero world is like, how human are they? You know, I feel like there's a metaphor for all of us having talents and how do we deal with our specialness and our humanity is always the juiciest question for me.
Right. So speaking of Courtney and Cameron and the episodes, you know, the where they get together, can you walk us through your approach to Cameron's character with his interactions with Courtney after discovering that his father is alive again?
I guess before, like, just there's in the fandom, there's a huge division about specifically that porch scene.
The porch scene.
Where Cameron comes back to tell Courtney that, you know, Jordan's alive again, and they have that kiss. And a lot of people don't know how to process that entire scene. So
yeah,
love
like
to hear.
So much happened.
So wait, so what's the actual question? I'm not sure I understand. I mean, look, it's a fraught moment. I think there's a lot of, one of the things that was really fun about that part of the season is that it feels very off the hook. Like nothing is normal. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so that's what's fun dramatically about it, because they'll do things and you're like, ooh, that's what's happening. And I think this is one of those, but I'm curious to hear more specifically about what the question might be.
I think essentially when watching that scene, a lot of people who, even people that were like adamant Cammy shippers at that moment, were very concerned with Cameron's behavior in that, because it seemed like he was, again, just parroting like what his father was saying and was kind of not thinking about how Courtney would feel at all in the situation. So I guess like what, like, was that just how it was supposed to come across, or like I guess how is China?
I guess our question's about Cameron, like what, yeah. What was like that moral,
what was that
wow. Well, I mean, I'll tell you one of the, and maybe I'll sort of make my way around to answering this in a way that seems satisfying, I don't know, you tell me. But one of the challenges, which actually I found really fun, that Maytal and I had, and, you know, Jeff and everybody who, as we broke these episodes, is to sort of, you know, create this runway for each character having specific, not entirely different, but specific approaches to what's going on. Right. So we had, interestingly enough, because Maytal had originally done, you know, sort of took a pass at those, at a lot of the icicle stuff, you know, and then we collaborated on it. And then of course Jeff got in there and everything, but it became really tricky, because what we wanted ultimately is that, even though we know as an audience that Icicle is crazy and insane and horrible, he's got to play the game of trying to come across with a sense of purity and clarity. Because if he doesn't, if he's like, I'm insane and horrible and you guys are screwed, you know, there's no way, I mean, just the whole story falls apart. Like there's no nothing. So part of the fun in those scenes is, the more sincere he is, even though he's saying crazy stuff, the more as an audience, I'm sitting there going, okay, what's he up to? I gotta watch closely. Like what, you know, it becomes, you know. So I feel like the notion of, you know, in those scenes where he has this point of view and then Cameron believes him, again, we're like, wait a minute. Like, it's just fun for us as viewers, because suddenly we're like, does he really? I do think that Cameron really does believe. He really wants to believe. You know, he's lost both parents and one of them came back. Like who among us would be like, my dad's back, but he's a crappy guy. No, dad, I'm not listening. You know, we all want to believe on some level, even if our parents disappoint us, which of course they always do on some level. No offense, mom and dad. I know they're not listening, but they could be, you know, and so I feel like that feels true to me, that he really wants to take what his father says. And also what his father says suggests that he can then have Courtney to himself. Like if he's right. You know, if his philosophy of we can all work together, and that means I can be with you and you can be with me and my father approves, and, you know, it's just too juicy for him to not lean into that. Even as from outside, we're like, is he crazy?
Speaking on relationships, a huge fan favorite, probably maybe the fan favorite relationship of the show, is definitely between like Rick and Beth, like Hour and Night. And given the chance to write their shared episode, you know, it's interesting, I guess, like you mentioned, that they don't exactly have that much explicit, like, romantic scenes, but a lot of subtext from the very beginning. I mean, like, they shared an episode's name in their introductory in season one, but like, they always tend to share episodes. So I guess we're curious about what's your approach to writing their dynamic? And
I love this question. Part of the reason I love this question is that from behind the scenes, there was no approach. Like, some of us knew, and we talked about in the room how in the comic books there's a thing between them, but we never dealt with the thing. Like, and so for me, part of the fun of what was going on is, like, with tweeting and the audience, is to watch the audience read into things that I know we didn't put in there. Like, I don't know, maybe on the final pass, like, Jeff sort of, you know, but, and maybe the actors, you know, they're such great actors, and they knew too that in the comic books, but there was no, again, Jeff is not a fan of superhero character relationships on that kind of show, because he feels like if they put them together, you're going to fall them, you know, have to pull them apart, and it's just going to derail what we're up to. And there was nothing. So all of that stuff is the actors, the innuendo, the audience, and we didn't talk about it. We didn't write to it. There was none of that. That's not in so my funny. Experience.
But then they got married, or they're going to get married.
Yes. So, and again, yeah. Jeff wrote that episode, and that was like in the future and all this stuff that we never saw, but we never discussed any intimacy between the two of them in those scenes. And I think everything that you guys, that the audience and you folks, you know, read in was you reading in, and maybe Jeff sort of poking fun sort of in the final draft, sort of making those things possible, but we didn't deal with it as a writing staff at all, ever.
That's so funny.
Interesting. Okay, so at least 2/3 of this show, as in Tam and myself, are absolutely obsessed with the ice hour dynamic, which is, of course, Cameron and Rick dunking on each other. So I know that your episode 205 introduced that. So please give us all of your hot takes on what all of that was, because it's so fun to watch as an audience.
It is really fun. I think, you know, one of the things, again, about working with Jeff is he's really got quite an expansive mind. And I think he's been in the superhero game so long, you know, and in TV and movies so long, that he really knows where he's going. And from what I remember is from very early on, he said, and I got the impression, and he was like, you know, at some point, these two guys are going to really go at it. You know, at some point, they're just going to tear each other apart. Not yet, but at some point, right? And so so we knew that that was part of it. And, you know, the actors, like, they're all, like, super good friends and everything. So it was also really interesting to know that, you know. And one of the fun things, one of the super fun things about my job is, and, you know, if you end up writing for TV yourselves, is, you know, we didn't get to go out to set largely because of COVID and stuff, but you can watch dailies on this system on your computer at home. And so it's just fun to watch the actors, like, do the scenes over and over again, and then watch, like, you know, when the director calls cut, and then how they respond to each other, and, like, what they, you know, sometimes bits of what they say to each other before and after takes. And, you know, that's just really fun. So, you know, I know, watching that stuff and hearing from Jeff, that they're all super good friends, you know, and, you know, meeting, I didn't get to meet everybody, but to meet some of them, and, you know, just, you can tell, like, you know, Courtney and Yvette are, like, really, I mean, Courtney Breck and Yvette are really tight, you know, and that's super fun to see, you know. So, and these guys are tight too. So we just knew that they would eventually, you know, beat each other senseless. And so you just sort of drop in a little bit of stuff and let them go. And they're such good actors. The sparks are already there.
So season 3 dealt with the Croc family. Mm. And they're a very interesting group of people. Can you talk about how they were used in the 3rd season to explore the theme of second chances and redemption?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I was really surprised. I mean, this was another one of Jeff's brilliant strokes. Like, I was really surprised at how he wanted to use them, both in season two and season three. And, you know, I was surprised. There were a bunch of things that surprised me about them. Surprised they got out of jail. Surprised they broke out of jail. Surprised they got out of jail, like at the end of the season, and they're like living across the street. And I had all kinds of questions, but, you know, just sort of like, yeah, you know, keep rowing. And then I have to say, and this is a very interesting thing that I'll admit to you, before I was on the show, I didn't really like the Crocs. Like, I was just like, oh, they're so mean, and they're so.
I didn't care for them either.
I was like, oh, what? Who are these characters? You know, and you know, actually, I felt the same way about Cindy Berman. I was like, oh, like she's just. I would never be friends with her. Like, what is, you know? And we all saw, like, I came to fall in love with both the Crocs and Cindy Berman the longer the story went on, and I thought. I thought there was some really lovely, you know, the sense of how much they valued, you know, the Whitmore Dugans and wanting to be there and, you know, be there in their homes and, you know, and all of that stuff. We spent a lot of time in the writer's room talking about how they would cross-pollinate, you know, and how Paula would, you know, would ask Barbara about baking and, you know, all of those things that endeared them to the audience, endeared them to us, you know, as we were talking about in the writer's room. And here's the other thing too, that we know in television, you know, that other folks don't know is that, again, Jeff had this whole plan. Like, he knew everything that was going to happen in the season. First day in the room, he sort of sketched out this thing. So we knew they were going to die. So then the opportunity became, let's make the audience love them as much as humanly possible before they lose their lives to Icicle. And so that's what we were doing, like all of those things where they were suddenly nice and, you know, and Crusher's having a beer with, you know, it's just sort of like, oh, these guys. So we were setting you up in that way. But it was super fun. And those actors are fantastic. You know,
they're hilarious. So you mentioned how much you've changed about your opinion about Cindy. Can you talk to us about that and Cindy Berman? Because she's also one of those controversial characters.
Yes, she is. I mean, so the first, you know, in season one, which of course I had no hand in making, there's that moment where she stabs her father and she's like,
Daddy, exactly.
And I was just like, that is the most, like, who is this horrible person who is doing this to their dad? And then again, like, I was not a student of these characters. So to learn all of the things her father had done to her, to also recognize too, in this particular world, that the man regenerates and can regenerate and, you know, like, her killing him in that moment, or seemingly killing him in that moment, became much less horrible, much more about self-defense, much more about, you know, it started to have a context to it. And then I think, you know, Meg DeLacy is such a terrific actress. And I felt like when she joins the JSA and is sort of on the outs, but sort of on the ins in season three, like, I just felt like there was such, I really felt for her. You know, her desire to belong, her desire to connect, her feeling like people didn't want her around. Like, you know, who hasn't felt like that? Like, that was, you know, I had a good high school experience, but that was partly my high school experience. Like,
You weren't turning into a lizard, though.
I wasn't turning into a lizard, though. That came later. No.
Did she, I this is a genuine question. Is she going to get cured of that? Like, theoretically speaking, or is she just like a lizard forever?
That's a really good question. Let me get Jeff on the phone. I don't know. It's a really good question. I think one of the things that's really amazing about Jeff, but also sets up a challenge for this show and perhaps other shows that he, you know, he's so busy doing a million things, is that, and you've noticed this, like, he's put so many things in motion that those season finales are like, there are 28 things to solve, you know? So they we didn't really find out what happened to those scales, but hopefully not bad stuff.
So we've heard rumors that the writing team perhaps knew that this show could end after 3 seasons. And was that the case for the entire production time of season 3, or did that kind of come up like at a midpoint? And then if that was the case, how did the writer's room dynamic change, knowing that like the major series-wide plot threads needed to be wrapped up in a timely manner?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I'm trying to think of a really good analogy in the regular world. This is not necessarily a good analogy. I was going to compare it to like death. Like, you know, we could all die. Like tomorrow could be your last day, and you know. And so I guess the reason I mean that's not a good analogy. But I try to float it because I do feel like there is the reality and the understanding in the television writer's life that you never know. You know, we're seeing a lot of, the industry is doing a lot of strange things, but there are shows that we're hearing about that they shot the whole thing and they never got aired. They got pulled, they got canceled. You know, there was a, you know, it was supposed to be produced, or it was produced, and, you know, or they wrote all the episodes and then they didn't do it, or, you know. So I feel like on some level, and part of the reason why I sort of laugh through that is on a practical job level, this, my life as a TV writer is so much more stable than my life as an actor was, because as an actor, like, you know, I was like on, you know, you'll be on one episode of one thing and that'll be it. Oh, I was on the one episode, you know, unless you become a series regular, whatever. So there's always that thing. There's always us looking over our shoulders and saying, well, you know, and every time you start a new show, it's kind of like, well, I mean, you hear all this stuff in the press, you know, you make the first 2 episodes or whatever, or the first 13, and you wait for the network to order the back 9 if it's on network, you know? So we say that and it sounds all quaint, but it's really like, oh, we could get fired after 13 episodes. Yeah. You know what I mean? That's always the case. So I think that when Jeff explained the entire season on the first day of season 3's writer's room, he was not talking about the show ending. Okay. Somewhere, I think, maybe around the middle of the season, he was starting to talk a little bit about the possibilities. And that's because, you know, again, like, you know, the CW was changing. We knew it was being sold. We knew there was the possibility that episodes or shows would not come back. And so we knew that, I'd have to say, and we were talking about it from maybe the middle of the season. And I don't think it really affected anything, because Jeff, who wrote that final episode and also obviously is the mastermind of this show, the show we all love, he was like, yeah, but he was like, I've always seen this as a 3-season show. I'm happy to make more, but I've seen it as 3 seasons. And B, he was like, I have a way to deal with it in the final episode. So we don't need to talk about it. So there was no debate. There was no, you know, nobody was like, you know, to go back to my horrible other analogy, nobody was like, oh, we could die. You know, it's like, yeah, well, okay. We know that that's always a possibility. So.
Right. So speaking of the unfortunate cancellation, obviously fans are desperate for more content. Should you be given the green light, would you want to work on a revival or a spinoff series of Stargirl? Is that even a possibility?
So those are two distinct questions. Yeah. One is, would I like to? Absolutely. Super fun people. Jeff's amazing. Love the writing staff. The actors are great. You know, I'm such a Luke Wilson fan. I can't even tell you. So I would absolutely want to do that. The second part of it, though, is, you know, several of us are already on other jobs and have moved on to other spaces. You know, there's no sort of galvanizing anything. Like, it's just not a, as far as I know, it's not a thing that is going to happen anytime soon where somebody's going to knock on the door and be like, okay, it's time. Let's go for season 4. You know, like, you know, it's just, there's not really, the possibility is not really sort of here. So would I do it? Yes. Does it seem like it's going to happen? Yes, they need content. It's a weird time in the industry.
Okay, so I mean, we want to be mindful of your time, so we do have wrap-up questions. So what advice would you give young writers who are interested in starting out in the business, and how can they make good connections?
Great question. I think the first thing is you got to write. It sounds really pedestrian, but you do. It's a job where you have to, you know, if you're on a writer's staff, you have to come up with ideas all the time, and you have to help create and generate and regenerate stories all the time. So the more practice you have at that, the better, you know, and so practice that. And I think on some level, it doesn't matter how you practice that. You could write short stories and be really committed to that. I mean, obviously, if you want to be in TV, you should be writing TV on some level. You can write TV scripts, you can write comedy, you can write drama, you can write comic books, you can write, create a web series, but just get out stuff, like turn out stuff. Because I think the other thing that we don't talk about a whole lot, I often talk about with my coaching clients is, and we learned this when I was in the CBS program, which is now called the Paramount program, by the way, is that we have to introduce ourselves. We have to market ourselves. And the way you market yourself is by knowing what kind of writer you are. And that means, what kind of subjects do you love? Why do you gravitate toward those? What gets your, you know, heart racing? Like, you know, to be able to say, like, I grew up around horses, and so I write stories about animals in trouble who are rescued by human beings, and that's my jam, right? To be able to say something like that, that gives the industry and some sort of analogy of who you are in the world and what your purpose is as a writer, like, that becomes really important. And we never, you know, nobody teaches you that in school. But certainly in Hollywood, they're like, oh, I'm going to remember, that's the horse person, that's the animal, okay, where can I put her, you know? It's like, becomes really important, right? So that's number one is write. Number two is, like, you know, think certainly. Writing gives you that perspective on who you are as a writer. But I think the other thing is, you asked about networking. Networking is essential. It's like, we all think we need to know J.J. Abrams, which it would be great to know J.J. Abrams. I don't know him. But networking starts with who's sitting right next to you. You know, so if you're in a writer's group, get to know those writers. You know, if you're, you know, if your cousin's, you know, cousin's mother's friend is, you know, a grip on a show, like, get to know people in the industry, because ultimately, and this is the thing, like, the industry becomes a really small town. And what happens is people will say to J.J. Abrams, do you know a writer? And then J.J. Abrams will say to his assistant, do you know a writer? And then his assistant might say to, like, I don't know, her assistant, do you know, you know? And if one of those people knows you, then they'll be like, oh, I know this guy, you should read his script, or you should read her script, right? So it's all, the more we get to know each other and support each other, the more we're going to be like, oh yeah, this is a good person and you should hire him, and I really like that person. And, you know, if you don't get to know anybody, I mean, we're all introverts as writers, but if you really literally just sit in your room, nobody knows you, nobody's going to turn around and go, hey, you, it's time. So that's the third part, is learn to network little by little.
So you recently launched your own podcast, The Secret Writer, and
Yes.
And you have a YouTube channel that is dedicated to helping younger writers, your creative life. Correct. So why are these projects so important to you, and what drove you to create them?
I was bored and unemployed. No, I'm just kidding. No, I think for me, my parents are retired New York City school teachers, and they actually met teaching in the same school. It's very romantic. But I think they taught me and my brother the value of service. You know, I think teaching is all about, like, passing on the wisdom from one generation to the next. And they really were about that. They dedicated their lives to, like, helping people learn things and get better and grow. And I just feel like I've got part of that in my DNA. One of the things I've learned, and I still have moments where, and spaces where I struggle with this, like, especially in these industries, writing, acting, directing, producing, whatever it is in the entertainment industry, there's, like, no handbook. You know, if you want to be a lawyer, if you want to be a plumber, if you want to be a teacher, people will say, do this, do this, do this, do this, and do this. And in these industries, like, I went to school to learn how to write. I went to school to learn how to act. Like, they tell you what to do when you get a job, but nobody tells you how to get a job. And nobody tells you what you do when you lose a job, or what you do when you're waiting to get a job. You know, like, all of those things are just not written down. So I have taken it upon myself, thinking about how lost I was years ago, trying to figure out what I wanted to do in the industry. And I pass on that kind of wisdom that I couldn't find to other people who want to do what I do. And I'm, it just lights me up. It's super fun to be able to say, here's a trick nobody told me, but I'm telling you. And that's what my coaching and my YouTube channel and my podcast are all about. And specifically, like on the podcast, we talk a lot about, me and my co-host Nick Jobe talk a lot about kind of like the inner game of writing. Like we talk about neuroses and fears and things that, you know, things that upset us, but also how we get over it and how we show up another day to do it. You know, that's what the podcast is about. It's not like how to write a log line, but it is like how to survive as an artist, as a writer in the 21st century. And I think it's stuff that people really can use. People seem to be enjoying it and we're enjoying making it. So all of that.
Mm-hmm. Podcasting is a lot of fun, as we've discovered
through
this.
Yeah. It is, right? Right?
Mm-hmm. So final question, and we want to end off on a good note. So are there any projects that you've been working on that you would like to introduce our audience to, or anything coming up on the horizon?
Wow. Okay. Yeah. So there's some, I have to say that in all transparency, there's some stuff I could talk about. There's some stuff I can't talk about.
Ooh.
So, yeah. Right. But, look out for more stuff I can say that. But in the meantime, I have a play in something called the Fire This Time Festival in New York, which opens next week and runs through the month. Actually, there are all sorts of events at the Fire This Time Festival. And one of my plays is premiering in the festival. So I'm really excited about that. The play is called For the Dark-Skinned Movie-Going People in the World, of the World. Anyway, so that's happening. So you can go to the Fire This Time website and look that up. I also have another play, another short play called Things Are Mostly Crazy, which is being premiered by Vivid Stage in Summit, New Jersey. If you go to vividstage.org or com, I can't remember which, you can find out about that. That's in February and March. I'm working on other stuff. I've got, you know, the YouTube channel is out there. My book, A Few Short Plays to Save the World, is in stores. And I'm working on some other stuff that you'll see and hear about before long.
All right. Well, thank you so much for agreeing to speak with us.
Great fun. You guys are really, it's really wonderful atmosphere. And I had a really great time.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
If you want to say like your social media, that's normally how we end the show.
Sure. Oh my goodness. You can find out all sorts of stuff about me at my website, harpercreates.com. And if you're interested in coaching and even free coaching resources for writers, you can go to yourcreativelife.com. And I'm on Twitter and at Harper Creates and at it's really Your Creat V Life, because I couldn't fit all the E's in there. But you'll find me. And there's a YouTube channel called Your Creative Life with lots of YouTube-y stuff for writers. So please visit those things and come and find the Secret Writer podcast, which is on all sorts of podcast feeds. And 5 episodes are out there. The 6th episode is about to drop, and we're making more. So all of those ways are ways to find me in the world.
All right. And you can follow this show at Star Squadcast on Instagram, Twitter, Tumblr. I feel like it's weird for us to put our tags on a specific episode, so we will.
We don't have to. our listeners have heard them many times. They know.
It's always good to advertise,
I guess. You can find me, I'm Cameron, at Ice Hour Night on Twitter or Blue Valley Breaking News on Tumblr.
I'm Adiba, and you can find me as Gert Starlight on every social media platform.
I'm Tam, and the last time I did this, I could not even say the sentence because I was so tired. So let's try to do this again, because I have different names for every platform.
Redemption.
Okay. You can find me on Instagram at That Killer Vibe. You can find me on Twitter at TKV Aronites, no dash, because I made that mistake before. I'm not doing that again. And you can find me on Tumblr at Aronites with an S. And I think that was all. Yes. Okay. I survived that this time.
Well done.
All right. Thank you. Well, thank you again for coming down, agreeing to speak with us. Thank you, the listener, yes, for listening to this podcast. And we'll at some point come back to do something else, probably. Have a wonderful day. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.